Hey, this is the Shadow Twinkie, and you're listening to Guildcast, the only place where assassins are treated with the respect they deserve. Oh, wait, never mind. Tell me lies, sweet lullabies, 'cause I can't sleep. It's cold outside.
Talk to me, then you can leave. I promise now, hold on to you tight. You say that it wouldn't be right, but I want you. Hey everyone, welcome back to this 84th episode of Guildcast for October 20th, 2007. I'm your host, Sean. Well, we have a lot to talk about this episode, including some big news with Eye of the North, some segments that were submitted to me by Lady Sinea and Logan Starlogic, and then, of course, there's the main topic of dungeons, which will all prove to make this a pretty long episode, I imagine. So let's start out with the people who asked to be mentioned this week. They include Holy Swords, Abath Doom Hell, Denozile Ghouli, and Exton Dexku, who said that he'd tell me how to pronounce his name after I butchered it on the show. In game news, let's start out with the Mini Mania contest that started this month. But it'll actually be going on for the next few months. What it is you go to guildwars.com, you look for where it says It's Mini Mania Time on the lower left-hand side. You click on that, and then it'll show you the complete rules to enter for your chance to win one of these mini pets. There's the Naga Raincaller, the Long-Haired Yeti, the Oni, the Shuriken Assassin, Zed Shadowhoof, or Vizu. These were minis that they gave out in a magazine promotion in Europe, actually, last month or the months before that. So this little contest here is kind of like, it's for North American players only. And I guess what they're doing is they're trying to even it up a little bit. But all you do is you fill out your info and then you submit it to them. There's no purchase necessary at all. What they'll do is they'll draw 125 names each month through November, December, and January. It's kind of an easy way to have a chance at getting one of these little mini pets. And in other mini pet news, there's also a way to get a free mini pet from an online magazine. Although, possibly by the time this episode releases, it might be over. But what you do is you go to www.gamerzines.com, that's gamerzines.com/MMOzine, MMOzine. And I'll put a link to that in today's show notes. But you go there, you download their first issue for free, and it'll probably take a few tries because their servers just got completely bombarded with this contest or this entry thing. But what you do is keep clicking on it, you keep clicking back, you know, you go back and forth until you can actually download this magazine. But once you have it downloaded, you go to page 20 where there's a simple little form you fill out with just your name, your first name, your last name, and then your email address. And you click submit, and then you'll get a mini pet code in the mail for a little mini Ceratodon, I think that's how you pronounce it. And that's it. It's just like that. They say there's only 40,000 of them available, so, you know, you might want to hurry. For update news, there were two major parts to an update on October 12th. There was the ginormous skill balance and the introduction of hard mode to Eye of the North. So let's start with hard mode in Eye of the North. Of course, hard mode is available for the players who have completed the expansion in normal mode. This means technically you must defeat the primary quest, A Time for Heroes. Once you defeat this quest with any character on your account, every level 20 character on that same account will have access to hard mode in Eye of the North. Reputation point bonuses for completing primary quests and dungeons are 50% higher than in normal mode. Reputation points received from bounties are approximately 50% higher than in normal mode. Random loot found within final dungeon chests is doubled from what's given in normal mode. Now remember that for later when I talk about the dungeon chest rewards on each dungeon when I go over them, because everything in hard mode is double what I'm going to say later on.
So now on to the rest of the update. As usual, I'm not going to go over the skills themselves because it was a big skill balance that they went through. But if you want to check it out, I'll put a link to the actual skills themselves and what was changed on them in today's show notes. But let me give you some paraphrasing of the most important bug fixes and gameplay adjustments from this update. There were some changes to the Hero's Handbook and the Master Dungeon Guide. Pages acquired for missions completed without a Hero's Handbook in your inventory can now be added to a Hero's Handbook. The cost is 100 gold per missing page. Similarly, pages for dungeons completed without a Master Dungeon Guide in your inventory can be added for 100 gold per missing page. The following Eye of the North title NPCs can now update books with missing pages. There's Gedril of Ascalon, who is the Vanguard Herald inside of Eye of the North. There's Kodan, the Dwarven Recruitment Officer in Gunner's Hold. There's also Tyr the Skald, the Norn Storyteller in Gunner's Hold. And then there's Lex, the Asurin Talent Scout in Radasum. And the changes to the Hall of Monuments include the fact that miniatures no longer need to be customized when displayed in a player's Hall of Monuments. See, what did I say last episode? This is exactly what we needed, right? So everybody just say it with me now. Thank you, ArenaNet. Now, let me explain a little bit more about this. What happens is the miniatures displayed in the monument to devotion are now marked as dedicated rather than customized. Players can use the monument to devotion to switch existing miniatures from being customized to being dedicated. Miniatures that have been dedicated in a Hall of Monuments cannot be dedicated again, but they can be used by any character. To prevent trade scams, the trade panel will warn you if someone tries to trade you a miniature that has already been dedicated. Also, you might notice that the report command is back. After reviewing the usage of the report command during last week's test, ArenaNet has decided to enable the command officially. The text describing the spamming and verbal abuse report commands has been updated to more clearly explain how they work. Players are never banned merely because of the volume of reports issued against them. Reports alert the GM team to review the actual chat logs of the reported player. The GM team then uses the same disciplinary policies that have always been applied to email reports of spamming and verbal abuse. So they're not just going to base it completely off of the number of reports a person gets. What they're going to do is it's like when you report somebody, it'll act like a bookmark so they can go back and actually look at the chat logs because, you know, they're the developers. They have access to all the chat logs, so watch what you say. Then they'll go back to actually see what was the offense. Now, this is how it works. To use the report command, type /report. Targeting a player and typing /report or /report followed by a player's name opens a new report dialog panel. From this panel, you can report a chosen player for leeching, botting, spamming, using abusive language, or having an inappropriate character name. Reports will then be relayed to and reviewed by the Guild Wars support team. You can report a player for leeching if you are in the same random arena, alliance battle, or competitive mission as that player. If at least half of your team reports the same player for leeching, that player will be stripped of experience points and faction rewards for the battle. Note that you can only report members of your own party or team for leeching. Reports of botting, spamming, abusive language, and inappropriate character names will be relayed to and reviewed by the Guild Wars support team. Note that reporting a single player multiple times for the same offense will not expedite or influence support team attention. A single account cannot use the report command more than 50 times in a 24-hour period. I think I mentioned most of this last week, but now it's official. Now, for the changes to the Underworld and the Fissure of Woe. There were some updates to that. It says, when entering into these regions, players will now receive a mission objective list in their quest log. This list informs players how many quests they must complete to finish the regions for the purposes of full completion and credit for the Hall of Monuments. Quests yet to be obtained are marked with question marks in the mission objective list until they are discovered by at least one party member. Chests now spawn upon completion of all quests in either of these regions. And then there were some little minor miscellaneous changes, which include The gold rewards for vanquishing foes in hard mode have been increased to 5 times the number of creatures killed. As with explorable areas, parties now automatically fail in dungeons if they receive a party-wide 60% DP while in hard mode. The guaranteed drop from the final chest in Frostmaw's Burrow has been changed from a diamond to a lockpick. Lockpicks have a consistent high gold value, while the diamond currently has a low value, due in part to the ease of acquiring from this chest. So I guess that's just to this one chest, so when I mention it later, just remember that. Players now receive the skill Brawling Combo Punch when entering into Franus Irontoes' lair in hard mode. So, now that that is all out of the way, all the updates and the news and all that stuff, let's get into some other news. Let's get into some Sean news. Yay! Well, you know how I have my second podcast, Oh My God, Real Life, right? Well, after some pretty rocky first few episodes, Jenna and I are actually, you know, we're really starting to get our footing with it, right? Well, now I've gone and I've done something really insane, and I've started a third podcast. So let me explain a little bit what this third podcast is. I started playing in the Tabula Rasa beta a few weeks ago. I think you know where this is going. But the game has really grown on me a lot. Since I'm enjoying the game so much, I figured, well, what does Sean do when he really enjoys a game? Well, he makes a podcast about it, right? I'm not going to fill up too much of my time in this podcast talking about it because this is a Guild Wars podcast, but I just wanted to mention it for anyone who might be curious about Tabula Rasa and think that they'd be interested in hearing me ramble on about that game also. The website for this is www.tabulacast.com. And no, this doesn't mean Guildcast or my love for Guild Wars is going anywhere. It's just kind of branching out a little bit, getting into the sci-fi MMO thing, and I think this game has to offer is just amazing, and I think, of course, while it has its flaws and everything, we're actually still in the beta. It's not even released yet until November 2nd. But so far, I like what I see, and we'll see how it goes. When you think of a dungeon, you think of a dark, dank underground area, like maybe a dragon's lair or an ancient crypt or something like that, right? You can picture, you know, the cobwebs covering each doorway, and then the walls are just made of these large mossy stones, and maybe there's even like a slow echoing drip of water somewhere deep within. Well, the Dungeons of Guild Wars introduced with Eye of the North redefine what you may have thought of dungeons in the past. There are currently 18 dungeons in Eye of the North, all with different creatures, environments, and objectives. Dungeons are described as chained instances, which are reset by exiting and re-entering them. But while a party remains within a dungeon, there is some degree of persistence between its zones. There are dungeons for each area of Eye of the North. There's 4 in the Char Homelands, 5 in the Far Shiver Peaks, 8 in the Tarnished Coast area, and then there's 1 in the Depths of Tyria. Each dungeon can contain anywhere from 1 to 5 levels, very similar to the ruins of the Tombs of the Primeval Kings of Prophecies. And at the end of each dungeon, there's a chest, which you'll get after you kill the end boss, which contains great treasures for everyone in the party. The enemies you'll encounter in these dungeons aren't your typical run-of-the-mill PvE enemies. These are intense, high-level monsters who are there to make your dungeon experience not so pleasant. Not only that, what I think is even more challenging and, well, frustrating, is the environmental challenges, such as the ice traps, those cursed snowball shooting machines. There's siege worms, and then there's these giant snowballs that just roll over your entire party. Things like that really get you out of that whole, like, tunnel vision of holding down the control key and looking for the red text to see what you need to attack. These are just things that come out of the blue, well, most of them, especially the snowballs, and they really make you kind of raise your alertness level a little bit. Also, when you enter each level of these dungeons, be sure to look for the beacons that give you the blessings, similar to what the shrine NPCs give you in the explorable areas. And of course, you can't forget your Light of Deldramore. This is a spell that you get with the Deldramore title track from High Priest Alcar after completing the Destructive Research quest in the Battle Depths. Now what this spell does is, when you use it, it reveals the location of hidden treasure in these dungeons. It also works to show you some hidden passages, some switches for trapdoors, and of course the Dwarven Ghost Allies. Oh, and most importantly, don't forget your Master Dungeon Guide. It's not only there to help you keep track of your dungeon progress, but also when you're halfway through with all your dungeons, like when you're up to 9 of them that are completed, you'll start getting mucho experience-o from certain NPCs. Now, they didn't used to do this. This is actually something they just changed. So let's dive a little deeper into the specifics of these dungeons, starting with the single-level easier ones. Now, these won't be in order of when you encounter them, especially because of the fact that you can go all over the place in Eye of the North, and there's no real linear storyline here. But what I'll do is I'll just go in the order of the number of levels that each one has. So first, let's take the Ooze Pit. You can get to it from Grothmar Wardowns in the Charlands from a quest called Watch It Jiggle. Most of the monsters you encounter here will be all types of jellies and ooze, hence the name. You'll get 1,000 dwarven reputation points upon the first completion of this dungeon, and 100 points each time thereafter. The chest you get at the end is a prismatic chest, which contains prismatic greens. Or it also, you can get one of 17 different gold items, or you can get a diamond or an onyx gemstone. The next single-level dungeon we have is Franus Irontoe's Lair. This is a very simple introductory dungeon with some straightforward design to it. It's part of the quest Kilroy Stonekin's Punch-Out Extravaganza. You kill some Stone Summit, and then some Ettins, and then some more Stone Summit. And then once you kill the final boss, Franus Irontoe, his chest, known as Irontoe's Chest, will appear. In this chest, you'll get one of the following: Dwarven Ale, or Aged Dwarven Ale. Completing this dungeon will get you 500 Dwarven points the first time and 100 points every time afterwards. The final single level dungeon we have is a fun one called The Secret Lair of the Snowmen you get from the quest Lost Treasure of King Hundar. In this one, you'll kill a whole lot of snowmen, making this actually a pretty easy way to farm Dwarven reputation points after you talk to the Beacon of Draknar, of course. You can get about 1,500 points per run. And then that's not even including the fact that you'll get 500 of Dwarven points, of course, the first time you do it, and then you'll get 100 points thereafter. But just from killing the snowmen themselves, you get right around 1,500 points. At the end of the dungeon, once you defeat Freezy, there will be a chest of Winter's Day Pass that will open, and it'll give your party members one of the Winter's Day holiday items plus a snowman summoner. So, onto the double-level dungeons. Let's start with the Sepulture of Dragomar. This one you get from the quest The Anvil of Dragomar in Drakkar Lake. It's a bit of a challenge, as you'll need to flip some switches and open some gates here and there, but this one's a good example of how useful it is to use the area map that you'll find near the beginning on level 1. This is on all of the dungeons, actually. You look for, it'll be in yellow text. You hold down the Alt key, and you look for area map. Very, very helpful. The hidden items in this dungeon, revealed only with the Light of Deldramore, include a Dwarven Ghost Ally near the area map on level 1, and then by the northwestern and northeastern res shrines in the central area of level 1. The hidden treasure areas are all on level 2, and they include left of the entrance before the ice imps, the western edge of the chamber before the bridge, and by the remnant of antiquities. The Dragomar chest you get at the end contains either an antiquated weapon, a rare gemstone, or another random rare or polymach piece. You also get 1,500 Dwarven points upon completion and 200 thereafter. Next we have Bogroot Growths. This one you get from the quest Giriff's War or Tech's War. Either one. You can get it from either one of those quests. And this is located in the Sparkfly Swamp area of the Tarnished Coast. This is in the Asurn Lands. Once completed, you'll get a bog root chest to open, which contains a bog root green weapon, or a rare gemstone, or again, any of the random rare gold items, or a polymach piece. You also get 1,000 Asuran points the first time, and 100 points thereafter. Now, something else I wanted to point out about this dungeon, it's pretty interesting for those fans of the Machinima series, Red vs. Blue. The quest NPCs and the dungeon boss names are phonetic derivations from those of the Red vs. Blue universe, with Tex being Tex. Tex here is T-E-K-K-S, and then of course Tex in Red vs. Blue is T-E-X, and he's on the blue team. And then they got Caboose, who is Caboose, and Caboose here is spelled K-H-A-B-U-U-S. And then there's Giriff, who is actually Griff in Red vs. Blue. And then there's, this is a good one, there's Zahim Mons, which is actually Simmons. So it's kind of cool they got this nice little pop culture reference in there, which they do so well in Guild Wars. These guys are experts at this. But you know what they need now? They need a Sean character worked in there somewhere. Maybe Guild Wars 2? Maybe? Guys? Yeah, I'll keep dreaming. Anyway, on to our last double-level dungeon, Arachne's Haunt. This is another Tarnished Coast dungeon found in Magus Stones through the quest Scrambled Reinforcements. If you use the Light of Deldramore at the nearest intersection to the area map, you'll see a switch, which, when activated, reveals a passageway that will lead you straight to the Flame Guardian and a hidden treasure. Killing these Flame Guardians is the way to disable all of those annoying flame traps that are everywhere, and this goes for all dungeons with those traps. After completion, you'll get the chest Arachne's Spoils, which contains one of Arachne's green weapons, or the usual rare gemstone, gold, or polymach piece. You'll also get 1,500 Asuran points and 200 points every time after. So, now on to the three-level dungeons. This is actually the most common number of levels, with 10 dungeons having three levels. So we'll start with the Catacombs of Cathandrax in Sacnoth Valley. This one is obtained through the quest Cathandrax's Crusher. Upon completion, you get the Chest of Cathandrax open for you, with the unique Isildur's weapons and the same other stuff I've mentioned a million times already. But you also receive a Hammer of Cathandrax, which is a quest item. In addition, you'll get the 1,500 Vanguard points the first time and 200 points thereafter. Now the next one is Rhaegar's Menagerie. This one is also found in Sacnoth Valley through the quest Veiled Threat. This one has a ton of secrets in it on each of the three levels. The Light of Deldramore reveals secret switches which open up the secret passages filled with the Dwarven Ghost allies and tons of secret treasure in each. Levels 1 and 3 each have 3 treasures, and level 2 has 4. A helpful tip for this area is to watch out for Hyde Splitter, who deals an insane amount of damage. You can actually hide from him behind a huge rock in the southern part of the little lake that they're standing in, and then you focus your attention on killing Rhaegar Maneater. If you kill Hyde Splitter first, Rhaegar will res him, so it's very wise to kill Rhaegar first. Upon completion of this dungeon, you'll get Hyde Splitter's chest, which will give you either any of the 3 Hyde Splitter unique items, or the Maneater, or various gold items, gemstones, or polymach pieces. For points, you get 3,000 Vanguard the first time, and 300 every time after. The next 3-level dungeon is Cathedral of Flames. This one is in Doomlore Shrine, received through the quest Temple of the Damned. It's a fairly easy dungeon, comparatively, but it still has plenty of rewards and hidden treasure. There's 4, and sometimes 5 of them on level 2, and 4 on level 3. Once you kill the end-bossed Murakai, Lady of the Night, her chest will appear. No, her treasure chest, you sickos. What am I going to do with you? And inside the chest, you'll get one of her 3 green items, or a gemstone, gold item, or polymach piece. You'll also receive 1,500 Vanguard points the first time and 200 thereafter. The next dungeon is Darkrhyme Delves, located in Majora Marches. This is achieved through the quest The Misanthropic Jutun Principle. I think that's how you pronounce it. Jutun? Jutun? The hidden treasure here is, there's one over the bridge next to the Beacon of Drachnar in level 1. There's one left of the upper dungeon gate on level 1. There's one a bit south from the upper dungeon gate around the nightmares on level 1. And then there's one west of the area map on level 2. There's one at the end of the center valley after avoiding the rolling snowball on level 2. There's one south of the boss area near the Beacon of Drachnar on level 3. And then the last one is south in the den area on level 3. The end boss here is Havoc Soul Whale, and if you kill him, Havoc's chest will appear. It contains the same stuff as the others, you know, the gold, the polymorph pieces, and the rare gemstones, diamond or onyx, and also has one of the 3 unique green Havoc's weapons. You'll also receive 1,500 Norn points the first time and 200 thereafter. Now the next one we have is Raven's Point, located in Varajar Fells. Now this one is obtained through the quest Defending the Breach. This one has a hidden chamber by the flat stone blocks in the center of the central chamber. It's mostly made up of destroyers, so this is another one of those areas that are really good for destroyer core farming, if you're into that. At the end, you'll open a destroyer chest, which contains one of 3 destructive green items. Or, of course, the gemstones, the gold, the polymorph pieces, yada yada yada. Your point rewards are 1,500 Norn points the first time and 200 thereafter. The next 3-level dungeon we have is Phloxen Excavations in Umbral Grotto, obtained through the quest Dredging the Depths. One of the biggest things to remember about this dungeon is the fact that the undead zombies, or the ancients here, will actually revive in 2 minutes, so you need to time yourself correctly. Also, the Stone Summit Gnashers are everywhere, and they are minion masters. So, while a minion master is usually a good idea in most of these dungeons, or at least some of them, here you might want to prepare yourself with something like Verada's Gaze, so you can steal the Stone Summit Gnashers' minions. If you find yourself being annoyed by those pesky poison darts, there's actually levers that you can use to turn some of them off. And another little trick is if you enter this dungeon through Vlox's Falls instead of Umbral Grotto, it'll cut down on the length of the first level, making it a little bit faster run. And once you've completed this mission, you'll open Zaldark's Chest, which contains one of the 3 Zaldark's green weapons, or any of that other stuff I mention in every single dungeon. This will also net you 1,500 Dwarven points the first time and 200 thereafter. Next we have Bloodstone Caves in the Sparkfly Swamp. You can actually get to this through 3 quests. There's Crystal Method, the Arrow's Point, and the Blade's Essence. Now this dungeon contains mostly warriors and a few dervishes, which cause mostly melee damage, so you can adjust your builds accordingly. This is also another one of those where a minion master isn't as effective because of the lack of fleshy creatures. As for hidden treasures, you'll find 8 total in this dungeon, so grab that Light of Deldramore if you have it. Once completed, an Eldritch chest will appear, revealing the green Eldritch weapons and the other stuff as well. You get 1,500 Dwarven points the first time through this, and 200 points thereafter. Next we have Shards of Ore, a 3-level dungeon in Arbor Bay, obtained through the quest Lost Souls. On this one of the biggest things to remember is when you light those torches, a ton of enchanted will spawn. So just be ready for that. You know, maybe make your tank run in there and do it. Once completed, you'll open Fendi's chest containing one of 3 Fendi's green items, or the other stuff that I've mentioned. And this is one of those really large point dungeons again, with 3,000 Asura points given the first time through and 300 each time after. Next we have Ula's Lab in Magus Stones, obtained through the quest Little Workshop of Horrors. Keep in mind there are a lot of conditions in this dungeon, so bring condition removal. As for hidden treasures, there are 2 on the first level, 2 on the second level, and 5 on level 3. Upon completion, you'll find Ula's chest containing one of 3 Ula's green weapons, or any of the other stuff, the gold, the rare gemstones, polymorph pieces, etc. This is a low point dungeon, actually, with only 500 Asura points given the first time through, and 100 each time thereafter. And finally, our last 3-level dungeon, yes, we're almost done here, is the infamous Heart of the Shiver Peaks, located in the Battle Depths and Bog Root Growths. This is obtained through the quest Heart of the Shiver Peaks. Okay, now this is a pain in the butt. This one is really... it's not hard, you just really need to know what you're doing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go over some strategies for killing the end boss worm, who is known as Cinder the Mountain Heart. First off, its main attack, Pyroclastic Shot, is not interruptible, so just remember that. Also, it has this Mountain Heart Carapace protection on it that makes it completely immune to all direct attacks and hex spells. The only way around this is to either bring poison, which will degen its health, or use the powder kegs from Budger Black Powder. He's a little dwarven NPC that's in the same room. It takes three of these kegs to bring down the protection, and from there it's best to echo some meteor showers, as many as you can throw at it, just to bring it down. And you have to kind of hurry because that Mountain Heart Carapace protection comes back up pretty soon. It's not a... once you get it down, it doesn't stay down. Another good idea is to put Protective Spirit on your tank, or whoever is running the kegs in, because the spell Flame Burst causes 400 to 500 points of damage in one hit. So, after you've killed that big worm, you'll see a Mountain Heart chest which contains one of Cinder's weapons, or a Magmus' staff. They're all green items, and of course, the other stuff I've mentioned. It's worth 1,500 Dwarven points the first time, and 200 points each time thereafter. Now, only two dungeons left, the five-level dungeons. We'll start out with Frostmaw's Burrows. This one has a ton of hidden treasure and a ton of lock chests, so, you know, bring your lock picks and bring your Light of Deldramore. One secret passage of note is on level 5 you can open a secret passage that will get you to the end boss more quickly. Now, once you kill that end boss, who is known as Frostmaw Kinslayer, a chest of burrows will appear, giving two items to each player. There's actually 12 green Kinslayer items that are available here, as well as the other items that I've mentioned a billion times now, I think it is. As for points, you'll get 1,500 Dwarven the first time and 200 each time thereafter. And our last dungeon, saving the best for last, of course, is the Elite Slaver's Exile. Now, this is an interesting and unique dungeon in that it counts the levels differently than the other ones. They have an initial level and then three middle levels, which can actually be done in any order, and then a final level. And you can leave these levels between the rooms of the bosses, and the game actually keeps the killed bosses as killed in your quest log. You'll encounter mostly Stone Summit dwarves here, but here's the thing. They actually count as servants of Abaddon. So you know what that means, right? Yep, Lightbringer skills. And since the levels work the way they do here, that means that there are multiple chest rewards also. You'll get a chest of the Slaver after defeating the Forgewhite, Justicar, Thomas, Rand Stormweaver, or Selvatarm on their levels. So you get one of these chests of Slavers for each of them. And then what these chests contain is they contain a diamond or an onyx gemstone or a gold item. So they're kind of like the lower chests. They don't have the green items in them. But then there's the Hierophant's chest, which will spawn after defeating Duncan the Black in the final level. He's the final boss. Each player will receive not only one of the Hierophant green items, there are 11 of them in all, or a gold item or a polymark piece. You're not guaranteed the green item. Let me make that clear. But they'll also receive a Deldramar Armor Remnant. Now there's 100% chance of getting a Deldramar Armor Remnant. And also an Onyx Gemstone. You'll also get an Onyx Gemstone. So that's three drops for every person in the party. And these Deldramar Armor pieces, what they are Deldramar Armor Remnants is what they're called. What they are they're for your heroes. They're not for yourself. And they're actually to change the appearance of the armor for your heroes. Just like the other, there's a lot of quests like that in Nightfall to do that. And what you do is you take them to Gunner Poundfist in Gunner's Hold, and he will craft the new armor for the Eye of the North hero of your choice. Let me point that out too. These are for the Eye of the North heroes, so you can't take like Acolyte Jin in there and get her some of this fancy stuff. So, wow, yeah. That was a lot. Hope that wasn't too overwhelming. But, you know, I figure it's about time that I gave some real info on some high-level stuff. Because I do a lot of beginner stuff, so here's something for the little bit more advanced player, I guess. So now on to the contributor segments. We have a skills and build segment by Logan Starlogic, and then after that I'll play the Word on the Street segment by Lady Sinea.
Hey, Logan Starlogic here, bringing you a small skills and build segment. That was my Cal Agro impression. Now, I know this is kind of sudden, and there was really no preparing at all, but that was slightly, actually just my fault, and my internet's fault. You see, I was going to do a LFG mission bonus segment, and I still am, but I won't be able to get it in nearly in time that I wanted it to. Simply for the one reason that Tal'Kora is using Unyielding Aura on my internet. Yeah, and that's a joke about how heroes can't keep enchants up, or at least they used to not be able to, due to their, their energy management thing. They would keep deactivating enchantments and, being Unyielding Aura, and, you turn off the enchantment and it dies, and then just, reses again and it dies. Yeah, it's a little joke there. But I thought, hey, why not do a skills and build segment? That pause was for the tons of laughter and bricks being thrown in my general direction. Why, you may ask? Well, it's 'cause if you know me or seen any of my builds, I can't make a build to save my life. Most of this information I've learned, aside from, self-teaching and stuff, has been from, the wikis and other people telling me, and, trial and error and such. I don't think I used more than 3 skills from Inspiration Magic until I finally did Hell's Precipice for the second time. That's how newbie I am. But what am I going to talk about, even though I'm a noob and don't know a thing or two about builds? Well, I'm going to talk about the Mesmer, since that's the only class I know how to play well. I mean, I know how to play a monk, but I don't know how to play a monk that well. I'm kind of a bad monk. Don't ask me the monk. You'll die, trust me. Unless it's an Ascalon or you're level 3. Either way, I'm going to talk about the Mesmer. I'm going to go on, a little bit of a rant here and talk about all the great things about the Mesmer. Especially their skills, not even getting into their dashing good looks or their witty sense of humor. I'll just simply talk about their skills. I will be talking kind of fast, and there probably won't be much punctuation. So if you don't understand anything, just, stop the MP3 or however you're listening to it. Download it if you don't have it downloaded. Get the MP3, go into, Windows sound recorder, and slow it down, and it will...
You'll be able to understand it. Maybe.
And so, if there's any skills you don't know what they mean, simply look them up on Wiki. I bet you several platinum that they're definitely up on Wiki. And if you try and trick me into giving you platinum, I'll put you on my ignore list, and I will, never talk to you again. But I'm rambling, so let's get started. Here we go. Arcane Thievery, Domination Magic, Spell. For 5 seconds, one random spell is disabled from target foe, and Arcane Thievery is replaced by that spell. This is extremely helpful in, alliance battles, not so much, but PvP, it's helpful for taking down something like a Touch Ranger, where one of their only skills is a spell. And you can just use this, and most of the time it will... pretty much cripple them. Not too helpful in PvE, really, it isn't. Unless you're a monk and you're gonna try and, steal an elite skill from a boss or something to use it against them. I don't know, I really don't use the skill all that much. Backfire, Domination Magic, Hex Spell. For 10 seconds, whenever that target foe casts a spell, the target foe takes 35 damage. This is an extremely helpful spell when used properly. Again, this is useful for taking down a Touch Ranger, but this is not the anti-Touch Ranger show, and we won't go into this. Now, it is helpful against Elementalists and Necromancers, and Monks. Really helpful against Monks. especially PvE monks who don't know better. And by don't know better, I mean char monk bosses in Ascalon. Any of those guys in the house? Yes, anyway, this is an extremely helpful spell, one of my favorites, and it can be used on just about everybody but Paragons, Rangers, and Warriors. Dervishes. This is also a really good skill against Dervishes, because they also carry a lot of spells. Chaos Storm. Domination magic. Spell. Create a Chaos Storm at target foe's location. For 10 seconds, foes adjacent to his location suffer 5 damage each second. Chaos Storm drains 1 energy whenever it strikes a foe casting a spell. To be honest, I've never seen this whole drains 1 energy thing in action. I think they're lying. But still, I like this skill because it's one of the few AoE skills for a Mesmer. So this is helpful when you don't have an Elementalist in your party and your person who plays alone, primarily PvE. I guess there's maybe some builds out there for this in PvP, but mainly this is helpful when there's no Elementalists around. Cry of Frustration. Domination magic spell. If target foe is using a skill, that foe and all foes in the area are interrupted and suffer 10 damage. This spell rocks. Aside from the awesome little word balloon that pops up over their heads whenever you interrupt them with this skill, it's also extremely fast casting, and nearly always hits the target, and nearly always interrupts. You just have to be fast on casting. It's just crank up your fast casting, and this thing is golden. Personally, this is one of my favorite interrupts, so, you know, this is why I'm talking about it. Empathy, Hex Spell. For 5 seconds, whenever a target foe attacks, that foe takes 15 damage. Like, kind of like a lesser powerful version of Backfire, but far more useful. Because essentially you can use it on any PvE creature, and a majority of PvP people. I don't really do PvP, so don't take any of my PvP advice seriously, because I really don't know. Empathy is extremely helpful against a majority of PvE characters, because with the exception of flare spamming Ellies, nearly everybody does some type of wand or sword or some type of original attack without a skill attached. This is extremely helpful. This is also really good against Rangers. This is one of the few really good skills against Rangers. That should also be warranting of brick throwing. Barrage Splinter Weapon Rangers, or just Barrage Rangers. Maybe like Vatlaw, Doomtooth, and Pre-Searing, I don't know. But this is really good because Barrage, when you have Empathy on you and then you use Barrage, you actually take damage for every enemy you hit with Barrage. Yeah, I didn't know this until recently, but apparently it does, and so I'm going to be using this a lot more on Barrage-wielding Rangers. Energy Surge, Domination Magic, Elite Spell. Target's foe loses 3 energy for each point of energy lost. That target foe and all nearby foes take 10 damage. I've never actually used the skill. I actually need to go cap it. In fact, I'll probably do that not long after doing this episode, because it looks like a great skill. But it's a great energy-draining skill used in tandem with Mindrak, which I'll be going into that in a few seconds. Hopefully, a few seconds. But this is a great skill. From what I understand, I can't really say much about it. Energy Burn. Spell. Target foe loses 3 energy and takes 10 damage for every point of energy lost. This is almost exactly the same as Energy Surge, except that Energy Surge is elite, and also it harms foes adjacent. I think it's adjacent? Adjacent? Nearby. Nearby. Hexbreaker. Domination magic. Stance. For 15 seconds, the next time you are the target of Hex, that Hex fails, and the caster takes 10 damage. This is very similar to Spellbreaker, except for Mesmers, and I think it shuts down. I think it, like, turns off after it blocks 1 Hex. And this is a great skill when fighting a whole lot of Necromancers, like if you're going to go Bog Scale Fin farming for the Black Mini Moichick. This is going to be a helpful skill if you're really bad at killing scale. I don't know. I guess this would be very helpful early on. Guilt. Hex Spell. For 6 seconds, target foe casts a spell that targets a foe, The spell fails, and you seal up the 5 energy from the foe. This is very helpful against monks, although, really, I don't see much help for this unless you're intentionally going out to, like, Capital Elite skill from a monk, like a monk elite of some type that's not smiting. I don't know. Otherwise, I don't really see much use for this skill, although it is really helpful when trying to, you know, kill off some type of elite monk skill capping or something. And that came out really weird. Mind Rack. I love this skill. Domination Magic. Hex Spell for 20 seconds. The next time target foe's energy drops to zero, that foe takes 15 damage. You'll see this being cast on you a lot by Murgoyles. Go figure. But this is very helpful for having skills like Energy Surge or Energy Burn. There's other things like Power Leak, which we'll be going into in a couple of seconds. But other great energy draining skills, when used in tandem with this, can gain you tons of energy while in the process destroying your enemies. Arcane Conundrum. Hex Spell. For 5 seconds, spells cast by a target foe take twice as long to cast. This skill is essential for extremely bad interrupters like me. I mean, I'm possibly the worst interrupter you've ever seen, but this is extremely helpful because if the spells take twice as long to cast, you may be able to interrupt them with something like Power Leak, Domination Magic, Spell. If target foe is casting a spell, the spell is interrupted and target foe loses 5 energy. This is also great used in tandem with Mind Rack. And so as you can see, everything just kind of works together. But then if you really screw up when using one of these hexes of some type, like you cast Backfire on a warrior, on a non-Hammerstorm warrior, this next skill is really helpful. Shattered Delusions. Domination Magic. Spell. Remove 1 Mesmer Hex from target foe. If Hex is removed, that foe takes 15 damage. Now, as I said, this is very helpful for when you screw up using Hexes, but also if you have a really annoying Mesmer ally with you, who keeps casting, like, all the wrong Hexes, and you really just don't like them, you can just keep taking the Hexes off the enemy. This is also really good for when you're a traitor, and you can just remove the Hexes. You can, like, be like, oh yeah, sure, I'm casting Backfire on that Elementalist, and then just take them off, and they'll only take very little damage, which normally can be easily remedied with something like Healing Breeze, and come on. Shatter Enchantment, another one of my favorites. Domination Magic. Spell. Remove an enchantment from target foe. If an enchantment is removed, that foe takes 14 damage. This is possibly one of the best Mesmer skills ever. Shatter Enchantment. I mean, come on. If the target is the foe, has any type of enchantment on them, any old type of enchantment, you can take it off, and they take tons of damage. I think at, like, max domination, it's, like, 100 damage. But take, like, tons of damage off. Also, it's a really cool icon. You should just look it up on Wiki just to look at the icon. It's really cool. But this is really helpful when fighting something like, I don't know, a Mending Warrior or a Tanking Mesmer with the, like, Shield of Regeneration. I don't know any Mesmers who do that. But, you know, if they did, you could kill them with that. Anyway, moving on. Mantra of Recovery. Fast casting. Elite Stance. For 5 seconds, spells you cast recharge 50% faster. This is also helpful for somebody. This is a great skill for, like, a Elementalist. An Elementalist can use this skill, and then all of their skills recharge 50% faster. They can be hurling out the firestorms and stuff way faster. As you can see, I never play my Elementalist, so I don't know that Firestorm is actually a horrible Elementalist skill. But you could cast it 50% faster. I mean, all the Elementalists go Mesmer for Echo. I mean, come on, what's so great about Echo or Arcane Echo? It's really not all that great of a skill. I mean, you get to use a skill twice. Yay! What are you going to do? Make it flare twice or 3 times and then just button mash 1, 2, and 3? Just seems kind of silly to me. But this is actually a useful skill. But moving on. Ethereal Burden. Hex Spell. For 10 seconds, target foe moves 50% slower. When Ethereal Burden ends, you gain 10 energy. This can be used in tandem with Mantra of Recovery, and the idea that if your skills are recharging 50% faster, you cast Ethereal Burden on one of your enemies, you could just be bashing them with all of these fire, or ice, or earth, or whatever you're using, and since they're moving slower, you can use AoE skills and causes them more damage. It makes a whole lot more sense to be using multiple mesmer skills in tandem. Power Block, elite spell. If target foe is casting a spell and that spell is interrupted, the interrupted spell and all of the spells of the same attribute are disabled for 3 seconds for that foe. Now, people who are fighting elementalists, this is great because if they're a fire elementalist, like 75% of the population of elementalists, you can cast this on them, and all of their skills will be recharged or disabled for 3 seconds, or however much it is cranked up to max. I don't know. I need to check. But if you use this skill, you can disable their energy and stuff. Problem is that this interrupt, for some reason, never seems to work for me. I don't know. I guess it's spells only. So, but this is a great skill when used against an elementalist casting Meteor Shower. I should probably use the skill more often than I do. This is one of my favorite elite skills. You know? It's kind of fun. Okay, now that I've made a complete fool of myself, and I don't mind at all, actually, I would like to, carry on, maybe, but I just looked down at my watch and at the timeline, and so I've been talking for about 15, 16 minutes, and so I gotta stop now before Sean kills me. And I know he will kill me, because he can hunt me down and kill me. And I'm sorry, I like to ramble and stuff, but if you guys like this segment, I may come back and do some more skills. But if you don't, simply say so, and you won't hear from me again. I know many of you will like that. Well, this has been Logan Starlogic, signing off.
Hey all, this is Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street. People keep asking me what I think about Eye of the North. Well, history has a way of repeating itself, and perhaps hearing a few old audio clips might give you an idea of what I'm going to say. So, here was a couple of things said about factions.
Now they're using DirectX 9, and before it was just DirectX 8, mm-hmm. And so I definitely noticed a difference. I mean, the scenery was amazing.
Oh, everything was beautiful. There was this one place that had this wave of frozen jade, like the ocean crashing over, and it was just beautiful. I've always been impressed with all the scenery in Guild Wars. It's really pretty.
And this one was discussing Nightfall.
All of the trailers that we've seen have had really cool-looking scenery.
So, a few of you, maybe like 40 people, when you asked me about what I thought of Eye of the North, you probably got something along the lines of a simple reply saying, "It's very pretty." Now, what I should have done before this expansion came out is I should have remembered what I did before Nightfall came out.
So what would you say, how do you like Nightfall so far? Does it exceed your expectations or what?
Yes, it does, because, you know, I just set myself up to not expect anything, mm-hmm. because I didn't want to be disappointed again.
Yeah.
So this time, we got a really good game out of it.
But in truth, you really haven't heard anything from me about Eye of the North, because basically, I haven't really played a whole lot of it. I know that there's a lot of content that I haven't explored, but nothing has inspired me to keep playing it, and I'm not really in any rush to do so. I did the Norn storyline during the preview, and since then, I've completed the Ebon Vanguard storyline and a couple of the dungeons. I've also done a couple of the special ops missions. I did really like those. You know, maybe it was just for sentimental value or maybe not, but all I know is I got really excited going into one of those because I was like, hey, I totally know this landscape. And it just so happened that at the time I was playing a Prot Monk and decided that I was going to tank so I could get up close and slash the char with my sword. So I cast Protective Spirit on myself and charged. But that's a whole different story. So, other than going on char extermination runs, I haven't really played a whole lot of Eye of the North. And I refuse to call it Gwen. Don't even say Gwen to me, unless you're talking about heroes. If you ask me about Gwen, don't be surprised if I tell you that I haven't really played with her very much, because I already have Norgu outfitted the way that I want. Now, this does not mean that I haven't been playing Guild Wars at all. Not by a long shot. A couple of weeks ago, I got the title of Legendary Survivor on my Tyrion Elementalist. So, thank you to Ashti for teaching me where to farm for some massive EXP, and to anybody else who I occasionally enlisted the help of in order to progress through the storyline. Most of the time, I just played alone with heroes and henchies so as to avoid getting killed by some random pug doing something unexpected, like luring a large mob. Maybe that would be expected from a random pug, but yeah, anyway. Thank you to anybody that I snagged to help me do some missions or to heal me or something when I didn't trust Dunkoro to do so. It was a long runway, but probably the most harrowing part of it was just getting through the PvP battle when you travel into post-searing. And then after that, it was pretty much, if you know the game, then you know what to expect. And now, what is it with the Hall of Monument statues? You would think that getting a title that cool would have a really awesome statue, but no, it's really quite unexciting. And how come the statues for simply completing a campaign are way cooler than the Protector ones? That makes no sense to me. Oh, and the Hall of Monuments. I have a few things to say about that. I find it, quite frankly, to be pathetic. The thing is, it's very limited, requiring very specific criteria of what's allowed to be displayed. Except for the titles area, even Senea's Hall of Monuments is pretty empty. I'll probably fill up the mini-pet area soon, since they made that change to having them dedicated instead of customized, because my problem with it before was that I want to be able to use my pets on whatever character I want, because I don't only play my monk. But I think that that particular change that they did is good, and I'm glad that they did it. For weapons, I have no weapons eligible for the Hall of Monuments, nor do I care to get any. I am quite fond of all my Tyrion greens, and of my crafted factions katana, and I do plan on getting a couple of tormented weapons. I'll probably buy them since they're a lot cheaper now. But yeah, none of that stuff goes in the Hall of Monuments, no matter how lead it is, so that section's empty. And as for armor, wow, okay. So I've got 6 role-playing characters, right? Most of them have more than one set of armor, and all of them look awesome. I've got good-looking characters. However, out of all that, I only have 2 sets of armor that are eligible. One's on my warrior, and one is on my mesmer. Senea once upon a time had 15k armor, but even then it was a mixed set of 15k wanderers and 15k judges, so she's actually never had a set that would have been eligible. My ranger's got obsidian armor, but not the pants, because I like the skirt that she has instead. My necro also has a mixed set. Do you see a pattern? I happen to like having my characters look different from everyone else's, and they kick ass. And as a result, I pay the price and have a nice, empty Hall of Monuments. I have no desire to go out and get anything to put into my hall either. It's not like having the Hall of Monuments there is making me go, wow, I really want to play more Eye of the North so I can show off all of my cool things, or I'm going to go buy a bunch of 15k armor that I don't like just so I can display it. Yes, I do know that there are a lot of people who have, as a result of the release of Eye of the North, worked very hard for new titles and such so that they can get the Rainbow Phoenix and things like that. And that's awesome. I do think that it's great that those people are achieving those things. But, you know, as for me, I've been playing Guild Wars a long time, and I'm a creature of habit, and I like the things I have. And if you won't let me put my Icy Dragon Sword in the Hall of Monuments, Then why don't you just call a spade and call it the Hall of the Eye of the North? Another reason that I haven't been playing too much of the expansion is that I've been, heaven forbid, PvPing. Do you remember, way back when, that ArenaNet said that their hope in creating Guild Wars was that people would play through the game with their PvE characters and then take those characters into PvP? And then later they realized, oh, well, there's lots of PvEers who are never going to do that. Well, it's taken me 2.5 years, but I've finally come around to doing just that. Slowly, I've gained some fame, and then just this past week, I hit rank 1! Woohoo! I'm so elite now! But it made me realize that if I could get that as a total PvP noob playing on a very, very casual basis, I could probably make rank 3 in no time at all if I actually started learning some builds and sticking with doing it. So, guess what one of my next goals is? Now, don't get me wrong. I have spent some good time in the Eye of the North. And I bet you I know something you don't know about it. I learned a couple of days ago what happens when a person dies in the Hall of Monuments. Now, there's no resurrection shrine in the Hall of Monuments, so if you're alone when you die in there, you'll get that typical message that says you've failed and return to outpost. If there is another person there, you will simply stay dead until the other person resurrects you, leaves the game, or zones back into the Eye of the North. I discovered this while playing with Logan. He put on a vampiric weapon and killed himself multiple times. So, thank you, Logan, for sacrificing yourself for the cause of scientific discovery. It's not many people who can claim that they have gotten killed in their own Hall of Monuments. You truly are a one of a kind. Okay, and one last thing before I go. I have to say, I'm so glad it's almost Halloween! Halloween is my favorite holiday in Guild Wars. If anyone from ArenaNet is listening to the show, please bring back the dead dude near the merchant in Lion's Arch. The guy that says funny things when you walk on him. I miss him so much. And I missed seeing tombs and Drox decorated. If you don't decorate tombs, since obviously it's not the same location as it was in 2005, at least do something similar for the Great Temple of Balthazar. Oh, and I love the Mad King. Emotes for prizes for the win! His jokes are the most awesome ever. I love you, Mad King! This has been Lady Sinea bringing you the word on the street.
So that'll do it for another episode of Guildcast. I hope you all enjoyed it and learned something in this episode. For the next episode, the topic is still... I'm going to keep it unannounced for now because I think I want to see if everything falls into place. But it should be pretty fun nonetheless. And don't forget, Halloween is coming up in 2 weeks. Possibly next week, I guess. Since Halloween is actually in the middle of the week, I don't know when they're going to do the Halloween event. But this will be the 3rd anniversary now of the Halloween event that they do in Guild Wars. Oh, and speaking of anniversaries, Guildcast's 2-year anniversary is coming up on November 19th. It's like a month away. That's just completely crazy to me. 2 years. So what I'll do is I'll try to get together some plans for an event to announce on the next show and possibly put something about it in the forums as well. And speaking of events, oh man, I'm full of these segues, huh? I wanted to start filming my next Guildcast Theater episode, but I need the help of you listeners. I need a ton of people, like as many as I can physically fit into one district. So what I want to do is on November 3rd, which is a Saturday, that's 2 weeks from this show's release date, at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I need anybody and everybody to assemble in the Great Temple of Balthazar, International District 1, for a giant filming event. This will be huge, and it shouldn't take too much time, maybe... I hate to commit to a time. Maybe I'm thinking like 45 minutes, maybe an hour, something like that. I'm sure it'll spill over, and we'll, you know, once the party starts going, it never stops with Guildcast listeners. But I just need this giant crowd for this one shot, or it's a pretty big shot in the video that I'm planning. I have this vision. But, of course, I'll make a post about it in the Guildcast forums so you get some more information there. And speaking of information, no, I'm just kidding. Nothing more. No and then. But that's it. That's it. No more information. So until next time, be sure to tell your friends and tell your guildmates about guildcast.com.
Okay, if you guys like, you know, me being on the show, I need to come up with some kind of trademark exit. Because, you know, like, Sinea says, this is Le Sinea, and this was the word on the street, or something like that. And, like, Goose is just that cool that he doesn't even need one. And, like, Sean, he gets to do the ending for every show. Almost every show. So it's like I need to come up with some kind of trademark ending. So I guess I'll say, this has been Logan. Or better yet, this has been Logan Star Logic. Or better yet, you've been listening to Logan Star Logic. I bet you now want to play a Mesmer, don't you?
You say that it wouldn't be right, but I